Michael Tubbs was elected mayor of Stockton, California, when he was just 26 years old. He was Stockton's first black mayor and the youngest of any major city in American history. And Tubbs became the first mayor to implement a guaranteed income pilot program, making him a mainstay of national progressive policy programs and the media. But when he ran for re-election in 2020, Tubbs was soundly defeated in a municipal election decisively influenced by a relentless and targeted campaign of misinformation. Now, the former mayor is telling his own story in a new memoir, The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. I sat down with Michael late last month to talk about the book and about his personal journey.
Growing up, so much of my intellectual development happened through reading memoirs, particularly memoirs of people transitioning from adolescence to adulthood. I remember reading Black Boy for school, and that being the only book that all the guys in the class really read, or reading Man Child in the Promised Land, or Makes Me Wanna Holler, or The Brief Short Life of Robert Pierce. Like, all those books really helped, and the autobiography of Malcolm X, they all really helped me imagine what being an adult could be. And I always said it would be cool one day if I had something to contribute, to be that sort of bridge from Alice to adulthood for somebody else. And then, as you mentioned, being the youngest, I've had so many crazy experiences, from sort of being born in a place like Stockton to being mayor at 26, being elected the same night Donald Trump was elected. And I thought that was an interesting sort of entryway to a commentary about sort of the promise and the peril of America, and how can those things both be true? And then I think sort of governing at a time of Black Lives Matter, while being a young Black man, governing in a place of home, trying to make sense of what the world has been for the past decade. I just thought it'd be important to have a marker now at the young age of 31 to look back at this moment in time, because I think there's something different about someone being born sort of post-Reagan, sort of coming of age during the Clinton years, with pervasive notions of what poverty and criminality were, being incredibly dangerous for folks like my family, and figuring out how to make sense of that. So, very long answer, but that's it.
No, it's helpful. If you're going to be 31 and write a memoir, I think it is useful to be able to articulate the reasons why, because I presume you've got a lot of living left to do, and that this is maybe installment one. And actually, as you talked about sort of the text that you and other, you know, Black boys were able to engage on your journey to Black manhood, I'd never particularly thought of it this way, but I wonder if there is a version of Black masculinity that says, like, these are the kinds of books that are not only okay, but acceptable and necessary to engage, right? In a way that maybe, like, you know, Judy Blume and Beverly Cleary is not what you want to be seen walking into school reading.
Well, what's interesting, I read Judy Blume too. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I thought that was very interesting, just to make sense of sort of the women and the young women I grew up with, like my cousin, and the girls at school, to get into their heads and what they're thinking about. But no, I do think, particularly in a educational context and in a societal context that defines Black people, to answer your question, Black men as deviant, as criminal, as not belonging, as othered, as sort of a permanent undercast, sort of having, there's a couple of books that speak to those experiences in very affirming ways. And in very disruptive ways that really, at least for me, gave me a sense of real pride and a real sense of like, oh, no, I can do this. Or, oh, no, like, my experience is valid. Or, oh, no, it's not futile, that they're like, people have found a way to navigate these things.
And yet you also begin the book by saying, basically, your mama said, do not go out into the world and tell our business. And I got to say, I was like, oh, yeah, I heard that many, like, don't go telling our business. But then you also give us a truly kind of painful glimpse into the, not just sort of the racial cultural experience many of us had of being told not to tell our business, but the very specific ways of or means of public shaming that had been used and deployed against your mother as a very young woman. So I wonder if you might tell us a bit about not only your mother, but your mothers, your sort of three mothers who formed the basis of this love that reared you.
And actually, I appreciate the question because it relates to the first question. And I also wanted to write this because so much of the narrative from others was about the absence of my father being sort of the driver and being the reason. And as you know, through my wife's work, the three mothers in the Tubbs household, we believe in motherhood. We believe in the importance and the centrality of mothers. And I wanted to make sure I took the time to honor my mom, my aunt, and grandmother, three phenomenal, very ordinary Black women, single, young, not highly educated, religious, contradictory, loving, tough, et cetera. So it really pay homage to them and illustrate that these folks actually are the people we need to be listening to really make this democracy real. And my mom in particular, I talk about how she had me as a teenager. And it was funny, Melissa, because in writing the book, it was the first time I understood why she was always so anxious and angry when it came time for me to perform, particularly at church. Like, it had to be perfect. Like, she was just unbearable to be around. And then when I wrote that first chapter and really thought about, well, look, guy, when she was young, her experience in front of church was being publicly shamed for being pregnant, of having to resign from her volunteer positions, of having to confess to everyone what she did in private. And imagine the shame and the guilt and the anger. And probably every time I was up there, she was reliving that. And I think sort of that's where that ethos of don't tell anyone on my business came from. I think she really had a sense of like deep shame in the way people use stories of teenage mothers or incarcerated fathers against people to make judgments on who their children will be. And also, I think she had deep anger. Like, why just shouldn't anyone care? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you don't make excuses. You do what you have to do. And it's funny because when I started the book like that, she read the first page and she's like, well, why did you write this? Like, why didn't you listen?
It's say a bit more also about your auntie and your grandmother and who they were. And I love that you use the language of phenomenal ordinary and that they were and are contradictions.
Oh my gosh, I love them so much, but they are so human, so paradoxical. in all the ways that are real. And my aunt, she is 2 years older than my mother. The first person my mother told she was pregnant and had really just, I was her kid too. So it was interesting. I didn't realize it was abnormal until I went to college, where I could go to my mom, my aunt, or grandmother for anything that most people would just go to their parents for. Whether it was lunch money, money for field trips, sign a permission slip, pick me up from school. Like, there was no clear roles and responsibilities that were so like, you can't talk to my kid. You can't pick my kid up. My kid can't ask you for anything. It was really a village. I think that was born out of necessities because of poverty, et cetera. And my grandmother was the real spiritual bulwark. She was the one that really taught us service. She had us at the convalescence home every month, singing and ministering and feeding and learning. Even when I was mayor, she would harass me every day about what we were doing about the homeless issue. And if I would go with her and her church group to give out socks, she had foster kids in her home that she fostered for years and treated them just like she treated her grandkids. And she actually worked at the community center, which became the bedrock for a lot of my work at city council. And she really kind of taught me about leadership and service without ever using those words. It wasn't until I got to college where I learned there was like a discourse around service, that there was service learning, I was like, we just did this. This is what you do. And then my aunt, she really stressed education. So she always gave me books. Every time I got straight A's, she would go to Barnes & Noble and literally, who does this? Max out her credit card on buying me books. So she bought me Frederick Douglass's autobiography. She bought me all of the Hardy Boy series. She bought me, any book I wanted, if I had straight A's, she would just max out her card and get it.
And I really actually cannot think of any better reason in all the earth to max out one's credit card except to buy books, especially to buy books for a young person in your life. I am down. Like, not that any of us should max out our credit cards, but if you do, do it for that.
Yeah, and I asked her recently, I said, Auntie, in writing this, like, why? She was like, this made you happy. And I mean, it's books. They don't hurt you. I was like, all right.
I was so interested. The writing here is lovely. And so I'm just going to pick a few moments when I want to just zero in. At the start of the third chapter, it begins with a very short sentence. My mom began to notice my anger. Why were you angry?
Yeah, I was labeled angry from like my first day in school. I'm looking at report cards, like angry. And I think, you know, when you grow up, like young people, children may not have the language, but people are born knowing what dignity looks like. They're born knowing what's fair and what's just, even if they can't articulate it. So I think I was angry at being poor. I was angry that my father wasn't there. I was angry at having racist teachers I had to fight with on literally every single assignment. I was angry at sort of how hard my mom had to work. I just had a sense of rage, like something just felt very not right, like very unjust, like something felt very fundamentally unfair. And I was mad and I was angry. And I think my mom noticed that because I was always sort of in arguments, or I would like to say in conversation with authority, whether it was her, whether it was my teachers, the principals, et cetera. I just would always have to question. I always had to push a little bit. And if I felt something was unfair, I had to let people know. And I didn't have sort of the politician's deaf as a 12-year-old. So I would just say it and say it loudly. And then back to the principal's office I go.
You also write about a period of time not being the angry young man, but being a teacher for the first time, or an educator for the first time, actually while you were in college. And again, because there's some lovely writing here, the chapter about this ends, I told them through tears that I would find my way back to Langston Hughes and home. So tell us a bit about Langston Hughes Academy and what you learned there, but also what does it mean to find your way back to Langston Hughes and home?
Yeah, so Langston Hughes is a charter school in Stockton. And I know there's a lot of debates about the efficacy of charter schools, et cetera. But beyond that, it was a school where the principal heard me speak and was like, I want you to work here over the summer. And I had no interest in being a teacher because I didn't like any of my teachers. But it paid like $5 more an hour than I was making at Barnes & Noble at the time, which was my first job. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it. And when I walked on the school campus, I just fell in love with the students and with the possibility of education, and that the students were shocked to have someone like me, so young, from their neighborhood, fluent in their cultural intricacies, teaching. And teaching content and sort of being in authority in the classroom, but not as who are great folks on the school campus as well, but not as one of the maintenance people or as athletic coach, but as an academic teacher. And they didn't have that for many Black males, most of them in their whole experience. And I was only 18, but they loved it. And for me, it was a way of sort of trying to do what I wish teachers had done for me and my friends. Because in my students, I saw so many of my peers who were brilliant, who were facing hell at home or in community, and would come to school and see those things calcified by sort of institutional bias, by implicit bias, by being pushed out, et cetera. And I just vowed to do differently. And I fell in love with it. It was hard, but I loved it. I loved the students. I loved their stories. And when I left for college, I told them I was going to find a way to come back, but I meant sort of like for a summer or for like a spring break thing. And then eventually 4 years later, that proved to be prophetic when I found myself back in Stockton after college, working as a teacher at Langston Hughes. And then my eighth graders were my 12th graders. So seeing sort of their growth and development, and in some cases stagnation, was also very edifying. And it felt so good to do the hand-to-hand combat, to kind of see progress and see change every day. And no, it wasn't at scale, but that work in that classroom, trying to get those 30 kids to grapple with structure versus agency, or trying to get them to understand institutional bias, or to really talk to them about socialization and these other sort of concepts I didn't learn to college, felt so rewarding and meaningful.
If you were to just tell the sort of beginning of your story, Stockton, and then the best known part of your story, Mayor of Stockton, one might think you never really went much of anywhere. And yet the sort of in the middle part, right, everything in between those moments of Stockton, there's a lot of engagement with a lot of the world that is not Stockton, whether Palo Alto, California, at Stanford, or your experiences traveling internationally. Can you talk a little bit about how the not Stockton parts of your story influenced and gave you kind of a way to contextualize and think about what it meant to be back home doing the work?
Yeah, the non-Stockton parts actually made me comfortable in actually going back home so soon, because I was like, it's not just like my only reference point in the world is Stockton, which is a great place, but a very peculiar place, and a place that is unlike most places in this world. So you need to go see some things. So my first time abroad was in El Salvador for Archbishop Romero's 30th anniversary of his assassination. And that was just the first time I saw poverty outside. I thought I knew poverty. I grew up in poverty. You can't tell me about poverty. Then I saw global poverty and I said, well, wait. And that was the first time I learned how US policies really created conditions in other countries that lead people to flee. I remember one of our host family told me how they were preparing their son, Henry, to cross the border to America because there was like no opportunity there. And I couldn't disagree. The village had no electricity. MS-13 was running wild. There was like a one room school for like five grades. It was like, what's the world is so much bigger. Like what's opportunities there for him to do? So that was super challenging and about, wow, the U.S. has a role to play, not just in what I see in Stockton, but also what I saw in San Salvador. And then I went to Cape Town for 3 months. And I thought Cape Town was going to be a big party. And it was. I had an amazing time. But it was also so challenging because I worked in the shelter for street children. And there they challenged all my assumptions. I remember them sort of talking to me about sort of fleeing home and being orphans, and talking about how European and American tourists would use them for sex tourism and got them hooked on drugs, which led to some chemical dependencies, or about how they were beaten by cops, but despite that, how they were so resilient and hopeful, and that they were, do not feel sorry for us. We're going to be okay. We're doing what we can. And also, it was really, I mean, like most semi, even though this word has been hijacked and it's terrible now, but as like most semi-woke people in college, love the ANC, love Nelson Mandela, love the Rainbow Nation and the Constitution with the enumerated rights to housing and shelter, etc. And going there, it really showed me how hard governing is, how going from paper to policy to implementation, particularly with hundreds of years of a history, is difficult, and how even Mandela was a man of contradictions, was a man who wasn't perfect as a leader, was a man who left behind some work to do in South Africa. So that was just eye-opening. So it was the same time we was beginning to become disillusioned with the White House at the time, with President Obama, but seeing like, oh, wait, well, Nelson Mandela can change South Africa just as the first Democratic elected prime minister. It's going to take time. So those paradoxes were really challenging. And really gave me a more, I think, nuanced view of change and what's possible and what's necessary and how to do it. And it just, like, those two experiences, I still draw on them in terms of making sense of the work in Stockton, the work now, et cetera.
Talk to me about being disillusioned with President Obama.
Yeah, I mean, my first vote was for President Obama. My first weekend in college.
You are so young. Oh, my goodness. All right. It's over. Sorry.
My first weekend in college was spent knocking on doors, registering people to vote. I was the first person at Barnes & Noble to buy The Audacity of Hope when it came out. Like, I was like all in. I was an intern in the Obama White House. But sort of at the same time, there were such gains made on healthcare, on LGBT rights, on just saving our economy from a great recession. There were still, like, in the messiness of governance, concessions that were made. Things were still moving slow. All problems weren't solved. And I think sort of I was like, oh my gosh, like, if Obama can do all these changes, is it possible? And it took sort of time in South Africa, time in that White House to recognize how leadership in government is necessary, but not sufficient. There has to be a whole alignment of media, of civil society, of the business sector, of Congress to really push through the changes that are necessary. So still, will always be an Obama fan, but now that that fandom is tempered with sort of my own analysis of how to get things done and my own beliefs of where our country should be and my own thinking about how far we should go. But at 19 years old, I didn't have any of that. I was just like hope and change and yes, we can. And what's happening? What, everything's not changed yet.
Can you tell me about Donnell?
So while working in the White House, my cousin, Donnell, was murdered at a Halloween house party in Stockton. And that was jarring, not because shootings or homicides were foreign. I mean, in California and Stockton, in this country, the leading cause of death for young Black and Latino men is 18 to 30 is homicides and gun violence. But this was home. This was personal. This wasn't a friend of a friend or someone went to school with. This was a family member. You know, you expect to see your family forever. And really going back home for the funeral, going back home and having to eulogize my cousin as a 20-year-old to all these people in the church, seeing the nihilism really set in with his friends, and then knowing that in Stockton that year, 55 other families like felt that pain, really caused me to think about sort of, okay, well, there has to be more to life than to me working at Google, being in the White House, going to Stanford. Like I as a spiritual person, I was like, God, like, what do you want me to do with all this? Because I don't feel good. I don't feel successful. I actually don't feel happy. I feel upset. I feel sad. I feel like everything's meaningless. And it was sort of in that sort of grappling, I decided the crazy idea that I would go back to Stockton during my senior year in college and run for city council at a time where the city had declared bankruptcy, at a time where we have more homicides per capita than any other city in this country. And I thought, okay, well, this is the time to run.
Talk to me about being mayor, both what you accomplished and talk to me about being mayor, both what you accomplished and the painful way in which it ended.
Yes, yeah, Stockton, California is home. So I was elected at 22 years old. Won my primary at 21, started office at 22, governing my old council district. And there laid the groundwork for much of the work people saw when I was mayor. But we did small things well. We closed down problem liquor stores. We opened up health clinics. We brought in the first bank to an unbanked community in 50 years. We started experimenting with community policing. I worked with the police chief to create the Office of Violence Prevention, a non-police office focused on hiring community members to prevent crimes before they happen, because cops can't do that, particularly homicides and gun crimes. And then when I was mayor, I was really laser focused on solving structural issues. I hate poverty. And I also think structural violence, the avoidable impairment of basic needs, is literally the cause for so much scourge in our society. And I also knew, being the first Black mayor of the city, being the youngest mayor of any major city in American history, Stockton's three times the size of South Bend, Indiana, I knew that this was a special opportunity and that it needed to be different because I was there. So we were different. We ended the golf course subsidy. We piloted the first mayor-led basic income program. We became the second fiscally most healthy city. We prioritized equity. We're doing things in the green economy. We were actually create a plan for homelessness, and that was able to raise some money from the state to being able to address it. And then I lost. And it was so painful because I'm a ruthless pragmatist. So even if the rules are unfair, before I can change them, I'm like, okay, let me master this so I could be in a position to change them so they become more fair. So I was like, all right, to be reelected as mayor, I need to do a good job. I need to do this, 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 and this. And objectively speaking, create a scholarship program to provide the next generation of kids a guaranteed scholarship to trade school, community college, or four-year school for the next decade. That's still happening, even though I'm not mayor, because I was very serious about building institutions. Create all type of community organizations, CDFIs, etc., so that the work will continue. And so losing her, well, first I was embarrassed, right? I was like, the whole nation is watching and I lost. Number two, I was hurt because I was like, I did a good job. Like I did my best. I literally spent all my time thinking about straining my relationships with family, friends, my wife to really focus on this job. And then I was also upset because of why I lost, right? Like it wasn't a scandal. It wasn't like lack of performance. It was sort of disinformation. And I think what people get wrong is that it wasn't a campaign year disinformation campaign. It was a 4-year disinformation campaign started from the moment I was in office and sort of rooted in anti-Blackness and rooted in lies and rooted about questioning the legitimacy. And I was worried about the message I would send to the community, the message it would send to the state and particularly to the Central Valley, because there's no real progressive, forward-thinking politicians or politicians people even know from the Central Valley of California. And they just were relentless and sort of attacked my marriage, wished death on my kids, lied every single day about everything I was doing. I was stealing money. I was a crook. I was incompetent. I didn't live in the city. I was just every anti-Black trope. And the fact that my folks fell for it, my community fell for it, that the anti-Blackness was enough to kind of change the direction of the city, really hurt.
So I guess that brings me to the last question, which is, so what is the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, I am laser focused on ending poverty in California. So we're launching a whole initiative and policy agenda and everything on that next year. I'm also laser focused on some form of guaranteed income being a national policy. So I started a group called Mayors for Guaranteed Income, continue to lead it. And now we have 60 mayors doing what I did in Stockton 4 years ago when it was just me. Overall, if there was a through line to my work, it's just really getting us to affirm, understand, and recognize the dignity of all people. And that we can only be a great nation if we truly allow people to at least have their basic dignity respected and their basic needs met. So going to do some more stuff in the storytelling space, like this book as one example. I'm going to continue to be in policy worlds and just do what I can with the time I have to just leave this place a little bit better than I found it.
Michael Tubbs is the author of the memoir, The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.